Welcome to the Prenda Podcast. I'm Kelly Smith, and I'm looking for the best new ideas in education. I'll be talking to all sorts of people about new types of schools, reinventing education, and helping kids love learning. I hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, welcome to the Prenda Podcast. Today we're going to be talking to Heather Staker. Heather is the president of Ready to Blend. It's a consulting organization. She's based in Texas, and she has a long and awesome history with innovating in education. She's done everything from Harvard to Christensen Institute to, I'll let Heather talk more about this, but flown around a little bit, and most recently has even been involved in one of these brand new, really cool, innovative ideas that has been talked about already before on this podcast. So I will not butcher your introduction more. Heather, we'll start there, but thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Heather, every episode that we do with this podcast, we'll focus on one topic, and you're an expert, a national expert, I would say. I'm not going to try to make you blush or anything, but on the topic of blended learning, which I'll let you define, but blended learning is, one of these up and coming topics. I'd say, it's grown a lot in the last decade or so in terms of just traction, and it's this idea of technology mixed blending with the humans and the human side of what is happening in a classroom or in between educators and the kids. The question I want to focus on today, though, is one particular aspect of that, if that's okay. We're going to talk about how does blended learning help kids take ownership of their own education. So, we want this idea of ownership or agency. We want to understand what's possible now. Instead of sitting in a class waiting for education to happen to you, you have these tools and the ability to go out and kind of create it yourself. So if that's okay, let's get started with your story, though. I know people are interested in kind of your background and how you got to where you're at. So get us to, kind of the main points in your education. You can go all the way back if you want.
Okay, sure. So when I was a senior in high school, I was appointed by Governor Pete Wilson to be the student member on the State Board of Education for California. And so that meant that I flew from my home in Southern California to Sacramento once a month for about a week and was a full voting member of the State Board of Education, which is a very unusual experience when you're 17 years old.
Wow.
And I will tell you that even from those days, I was able to observe so many schools and so many students. And we didn't only meet in Sacramento, we also toured the state. And so I saw juvenile correction facilities and public schools and small schools and rural and urban and all varieties of institutions where we educate children. And my role was to be the voice of the child. And it's impossible for one person to represent the voice of all children in as diverse of a state as California. But I can say that from that vantage point, I certainly developed a sympathy for the good, the bad, the ugly of what we see in schools. And there are so many teachers who do a remarkable job, which goes without saying, the amount of time that they put in, the long hours, the small paychecks. It's not to be underestimated. And there are a lot of children who really depend on school for their success and their launching into life ahead of them. So it was sobering, I would say, to see this, my peers across the state from that vantage point. Anyway, I went on from there.
Okay, wait, can we stop real quick?
Sure.
How in the world did you get invited by the governor to be on the Board of Education? You must have been some sort of superstar as a high school student.
It's a funny thing. My junior English teacher at my high school, I went to a big public high school, and she posted scholarship applications on the back of her wall, and I would grab them. And in fact, I secured a few very random scholarships as a result of that. I secured a scholarship for a essay about the importance of Washington crossing the Delaware River. That's just one example of, anyway, but one of the applications was for this position.
Right.
And so I filled it out, and one thing led to another, and I was interviewing with the State Board of Education and then appeared before the governor's appointment secretary and then before the Senate for an advice and consent hearing to approve the appointment. So it was an amazing experience. And this was back before the days of cell phones and even credit cards. So my dad would give me a couple 20s and stick me on an airplane. It was a very unusual experience.
That's so cool. Wow. So you've been in the trenches of education and specifically even education reform. And I know people have been looking at these questions for a very long time, way before you were 17. So I mean, that's cool as a kid to be able to kind of see that in a way that most students just don't get access to. Wow.
It was definitely cool, but it was also, as I said, it was sobering. I truly felt intimidated by the Department of Education and the heft of the superstructure that it takes to run these big school programs, and was impressed by the teachers. I wasn't always as impressed by the bureaucracy and by the administrative and compliance flavor that we have to our public school institution writ large. And so that was one of the reasons that I did end up pursuing an MBA with a focus on education and social enterprise, with the thought of, can we breathe some innovation into these big behemoth structures to make them run more efficiently and to serve our students in a way that's more nimble and agile and allows us to update over time as the science improves.
So were you education all the way? I know you went to Harvard for your undergrad and then did an MBA. Was it always education was in your head? Like, I'm going to get involved in this?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I was definitely had the practical side too. I graduated from college and needed a car. So I took a job with Procter & Gamble where you got a free company car. but I always have had a heart for social issues. And I've just always felt like I have a calling to do good for people. And that's been more compelling to me than like a profit motive or something like that. I have 5 children of my own, so I really love children. And I've always felt like it's my calling to try to be an advocate for children.
Amazing. All right. So you're at your MBA, you're starting to focus on some of these social questions. And then where does that lead from there?
During my time at Harvard Business School, I met Clayton Christensen, who's widely considered to be the father of innovation theory, and his theory of disruptive innovation and how it's a transformative force that can change a sector that was complicated and expensive and inaccessible into a sector that is affordable and accessible and within the reach of the common man. It's a very important theory and an important idea that is applicable in a range of industries, including in the social sector, in healthcare and education and the economy. So I was really attached to his line of thinking. I became a student of his. And when I finished business school, after a stint at McKinsey and a couple of other roles, I ended up applying to be a researcher at what was then Innosight Institute. It is now named the Clayton Christensen Institute. Working in his education practice to think about how do we transpose those ideas of innovation into the world of education to bring a vigor and new vitality to some of the problems that have vexed us for a long time.
So talk about that a little bit. I think that's really fascinating. And just pausing here for readers that have never heard of Clayton Christensen or the book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and some of this disruptive innovation theory, take a minute, read Wikipedia. You don't have to do the whole book, but you should understand at least the basics of this as applied to everything. I mean, technology and computers and what are some of the, I mean, but the recent ones are about healthcare and education. And I think, like you're saying, there's big implications here. You're starting to think about this framework as applied to education. And as part of, you know, Clayton Christensen by that time had a following, he was recognized. I'm sure you had access to all kinds of, I mean, give me an example of some of the engagements that you might've done, you know, and what types of disruptive innovations are you, you know, working on at that time?
Sure. Well, one of my very first assignments was to write a series of case studies about this new thing that was emerging in education called blended learning. And it was a word that was being used, and we weren't sure exactly what it meant. The book Disrupting Class had already been published in 2008 with Clayton Christensen and Michael Horn and Curtis Johnson. And in that book, they predicted that by 2019, 50% of high school courses would be online in some form or fashion. So they said that online learning was this disruptive force that had the potential to distribute power out to those at the margins to really allow the end user to have more control over their education. Here we're starting to hear some of these agency themes that I know you want to talk about a little bit later in this podcast, but that they foresaw that online learning had the power to push control out more to the people at the margin. And that was a disruptive, it was on a disruptive trajectory that was poised to transform the way the world learns. Quite a remarkable prediction at the time.
2008, so when
I,
you said?
That was in 2008. And I joined them in 2010, I believe. And so it was right a couple of years after online learning was starting to become a thing. And yet we still weren't sure exactly how it would grow to the scale imagined in the book Disrupting Class.
When was Coursera? Do you remember? Coursera was like the first online courses company. I mean, there were other things before that, but that was
amazing. This is a good question. I'm not sure when Coursera hit the scene. It was back in the days in the K-12. Coursera seemed to appeal more to higher education folks. And I was really focused on K-12. And it was back in the days when Florida Virtual School was just emerging.
Right.
K-12 Incorporated, Connections Academy, some of these full-time virtual school programs were just hitting the scene, as well as some supplemental programs where you could do online lessons in your school. When you introduced me, Kelly, you mentioned that blended learning was this mix of technology and face-to-face instruction. And I want to just add a nuance to that, a little bit of clarification to that, that really when we see blended learning and that early research I was asked to do of writing these case studies about a variety of schools that were doing blended learning, unearthed that there's a even more crystal clear definition of it. And it's when it's a formal education program that allows students to do some of their learning online. So the lessons themselves are online. And that really shifts the teacher's role, because if the teacher's no longer standing at the chalkboard delivering that instruction, then it opens up opportunities for that teacher to be doing other things. So blended learning involves some online learning, but combined in a brick and mortar face-to-face experience. And it's really that key part of it, of those online lessons where there's an intentional pivot of learning into the hands of the students that makes such a big difference.
Heather, I think it probably makes sense just for listeners here to just talk about some of the things that are not blended. I've heard you do a great job of articulating what's not blended learning, right? So maybe like a technology rich situation. And then it sounds like from this, you would also say pure online instruction, like what K-12 has been doing, wouldn't classify as blended learning generally.
You nailed it. So first, technology-rich instruction is so often conflated with blended learning erroneously. Technology-rich instruction is where we equip students with an iPad or a laptop, and they do their learning with technology, but it's still teacher-led. It's still the teachers delivering that instruction instead of actually giving students some control of the time, place, path, or pace of their learning. And it's really a common problem in our schools is that we are so prone to do these one-to-one initiatives and give our schools, give all of our students laptops and think that we're giving them power when in fact we're just giving them a really fancy pencil. A really fancy way of taking notes or accessing a graphing calculator. And so it's an important distinction to think that if we're trying to give them ownership, if we're trying to give them agency, if we're trying to build in them the skills of driving their own learning, that we actually have to do that intentional pivot of giving them the lesson itself so that they have some control over the time, place, path, and pace of their learning. Conversely, full-time virtual schooling isn't blended learning. So if a student's doing, say, a K-12 charter school that's full-time virtual from home, that's not blended learning because it doesn't have that face-to-face component. But there are a variety of ways students can do blended learning. So they might come to school, do the pep rallies, do the face-to-face social experiences in clubs, but their learning is all online. And that could be blended learning. Or it could be a more modest amount of online learning where the students are coming to school doing mostly face-to-face traditional instruction, but have a short rotation where they do some online learning. There's a variety.
It's so interesting. And I remember, and people that have been listening to this will know a little bit of my story. I started just as a computer guy. I started teaching kids computer programming back in 2013. And I didn't know the terms for any of this, but I thought, what if, like, it just doesn't make sense for me to be up in front, like trying to get everybody to do the same thing. And so a lot of what I started with was this assumption that everything's online, all the content, anybody in the world could become a computer programmer if they have an internet connection and a computer. And yet most people don't. And so my question was, well, why doesn't that happen? And I started these code clubs. So the kids would come and they would just go at their own pace. Everybody's, what are your four things? Time, place, path, pace. So you say it so fast, but I need to get this because this is good. And what was interesting is that it worked. There was something magical about being there in person, even though everybody was doing something different in the room. They were getting up out of their chair and like looking. Somebody made an interesting sound effect over here, and you know, four kids will come over and see what they're making, and then that builds all these psychological rewards that just aren't there. I mean, my theory is that online learning is tough because we're dealing with humans. You know, robots could do it because they have infinite motivation and energy, but a human, you know, you sit there and you try to learn a lesson and then you get stuck on one thing and it's very easy to just give up or get distracted. I don't know if that fits with.
No, it absolutely does. It sounds like you're one of the early pioneers who was willing to give it a chance. And one of those adults who was comfortable with a different ethic for what the classroom should feel like, because it is uncomfortable sometimes to see these learners walking around the room, getting help from peers, taking control of their own learning instead of sitting in a nice, neat, tidy row.
It's not orderly. Quietly.
It's a different type of order. It's a self-organized, organic order, and it requires a real mindset set shift for the adults.
Yeah, interesting. So tell me about some of the barriers that, we should continue your story because we sort of left off. You're still at the Clayton Christensen Institute.
Well, that was the main thing that really got me interested in how online learning is changing the way the world learns, and particularly how it's emerging into the brick and mortar in this phenomenon that we now call blended learning. So with that, I wrote a book with Michael Horn that's somewhat of a sequel to Disrupting Class, and it's called Blended: Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. And we just came out with a workbook a few months ago called the Blended Workbook. And so these are tools to help schools think about how do we grapple with online learning as something that is actually a powerful resource that we can use to change design and instruction fundamentally and for the better, ideally, in our schools.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit? So you've been doing this now. I know you give trainings, you go all over the country, you work with school districts. You've personally probably talked to thousands of educators about blended learning, all of them choosing to come willingly to your session. So this isn't a question of will, I would say, but there are some kind of, as you were talking about just a minute ago, I think there's some switches, right, in terms of the way just the fundamental philosophy of what's happening in school that maybe could take people some time to get their heads around, or it requires just a different approach. Can you talk about that? And then I'd love to hear from your perspective, if that's where the big issue is, or is it more tactical later, right? Is it more about, well, how do I do it, as opposed to being willing to accept this different philosophy? That makes sense? There's like sort of...
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is... absolutely prerequisite work that adults need to do with our mindsets to allow for blended learning to blossom in a way that will redound to the benefit of students. Absolutely. So I think you're right to ask about that mindset step, and it's truly an important first step. And it's partly the idea that we can transform our classrooms from an environment where children are helpless and passive into an environment where they are agents of their own learning. And that is a huge mindset shift. It makes the classroom look different. It makes the discussions that you have with parents sound different. It puts control in the hands of students in a way that often makes the students uncomfortable, because no longer are they allowed to sit back and passively listen and ostensibly take notes, but they actually are agents who are squarely responsible for driving their own learning. It changes so much. And you're absolutely right to identify that mindset piece as an important first step.
It changes the teachers' self-perception too, right? Like if before I was the one with the answers, I am no longer the one with the answers. I mean, that can be hard.
Regrettably, I think we've spent a few years spinning our wheels on that, thinking our teachers being replaced by computers. And it's emerging for me more and more clearly that teachers are not replaced by computers, but their role shifts in what I believe is a super awesome way. And that is that it allows teachers the opportunity to provide individual tutoring, feedback, coaching, mentoring, develop one-on-one relationships. A lot of those things that teachers have long wanted to do with their children and their learners, but haven't had the time to do. So it does require a shift for teachers and new skills. Not all teachers know how to develop those one-on-one coaching relationships. And it's a great opportunity. It also requires some retraining.
I've been wanting to do, and this is for another podcast, but get into the Two Sigma problem that Benjamin Bloom figured out, that basically just figured out that one-on-one is way better than in a class, which I think anybody would recognize, right? Having sat through lectures as somebody that either gets it already and is waiting for some new content that I don't understand, or also being the one in the class that feels lost. Either way, you know, and I've done both of those. It would be great if I could just sit down with someone that's willing to work with me and understand what I, so the kinds of things that you're talking about, just one-on-one, understand where your gaps are, helping you approach it a different way and figure it out.
Absolutely. And that Two Sigma study, although the effect sizes were surprising because they were so large, I don't think the fundamental takeaway from it was surprising, which is that everyone benefits from having an individual tutor at their side. And obviously, if we had our perfect world, we would give each child a buddy that would sit by their side and point out the way. But with that not possible, the beauty of the disruptive innovation of online learning is that it allows us to restructure schooling in ways that more approximate that ideal. And that's really exciting.
Awesome. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the mindset shift. You want to talk about, I know you go do these trainings and you work with people specifically. What kind of coaching and help do you give? And specifically on this topic of agency, right? Like, are there things that you can do? I know one is terrifying to people is, what if the kid, like if I say you're in charge of your learning and the kid doesn't choose to learn, what happens there? You know, this is a place that scares educators, it scares parents. You know, how do you approach that? And how do we, as we look at blended learning, think about that?
No, it's a really good question. And after that mindset piece, or in simultaneous to that mindset piece, there's important onboarding work for students to be prepared for that kind of an environment. So when I take my children to the grocery store and they're little, I don't immediately allow my toddlers to run down the aisle and just pull everything off the shelves that they want to. But instead, it's all based on where they're developmentally ready. So at first, they might be riding along in like a baby Bjorn. And then they get old enough and ready enough that they can sit in the cart. And then when they've graduated from sitting in the cart responsibly, then maybe I'll let them out of the cart, but they have to be holding my hand. And it's only once they've really mastered that I'll let them wander up and down the aisle as long as they stay within eyesight. And we know that those same skill development principles apply in any environment where we're granting students or children a lot of agency, where we have to start out by teaching them competency plus one until they get to the point of being able to drive their own learning. Never would I say, take a handful of 11th graders who have never had prerogative over their own learning and immediately equip them with these online tools and resources and a big wide open campus and let them have at it. Instead, we obviously need to give them the structures and and allow them to grow into those freedom levels. So there's those levels of independence as they demonstrate their ability to handle that agency.
Interesting. So little by little, and then you have to have the fundamental assumption that everyone will choose it if given the right kind of conditioning and really, you know, sort of the gradual takeoff.
I think you have to have the fundamental assumption that every child can learn.
Yeah.
Every child is a genius, has genius in them. Every child has a gift and every child can learn. Now, I don't think you have the fundamental assumption that every child will stay on pace or that every child can do this without intervention and support and running partners to help them along the way.
Okay. That's interesting. And listening to every child can learn, every child is capable, brings me to one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is the Acton Academy. You did something really interesting a few years ago. You were living in Hawaii at the time and you found out about this new school in Texas. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I was working on blended learning, writing for the Christensen Institute remotely. And one of the schools that I came across was this micro school, a tiny school based in Austin, Texas. And I interviewed the Jeff Sandifer, who founded the school with his wife, Laura, and was so taken by the school that I literally hung up the phone from that interview and called my husband and said, if we don't move with our family to Austin, Texas to enroll our children in the school, then I want to start one myself. And it was pretty crazy to admit that not much longer later, we moved 2,000 miles to Texas so that we could put our own children in this school. It's now a a booming network of micro schools. There's over 40 of them around the country, and I think 5,600 applications pending. So it's really a growing phenomenon. One of the things that's notable about Acton Academy is I would say that they're on one end of the continuum in terms of really allowing students to drive their own learning. So it's been important for my research because it gives me a taste of that, what's possible, and of that end of the extreme. And really to be provocative with other people when they question whether or not children are capable of this. I've seen it. My own children live it. I've seen hundreds of children doing it. And it's amazing to see how it changes the design of the school.
Yeah, it becomes real. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, we've talked to Andrew Collins on this podcast in the past, and he was involved in starting the Phoenix chapter of the Acton Academy, which is in its first year. So they're still pretty new. You've been now in Texas for a few years. You've seen and been involved. I know you're not the type of passive parent that just sends your kids to school. So you're really in the works here. And when you say extreme, I mean, they use the word hero, right? You're on a hero's journey. Talk to me a little bit about the culture and kind of how that agency is imbibed in these children from a very young age.
Sure. So they start with the idea that every child is on a hero's journey, that all of us, in fact, are on a hero's journey where we're the protagonist of our own story. And along the way, we'll make mistakes, we'll take risks, we'll fail, we'll try again. And that narrative really helps everyone in the community think about how we do take ownership of our choices and move forward as the heroes of our own plot. The way that they're extreme, I did use that word, is that they don't actually have any chalkboard-based instruction, any teacher lecture whatsoever. So for math, it's online learning with Khan Academy and Dreambox. With writing, it's peer critiquing and looking at examples of experts and lots of peer review and peer work with writers' workshops. For reading, it's reading deep books and writing reports about them on great books. So they have a variety of different curriculum choices that don't depend on top-down instruction, which frees up the role of the guides to be providing that running partner role that I do think is so important. Now, this is not to say that that paradigm or design choice is right for everyone, but it does help for me because at least it gives me an example of an extreme case of allowing students to really be agents of their own learning and drive their own learning.
Fascinating. Do your kids like it?
You know, there are things they love about it. They do love, and they don't remember. So we've been there. My oldest is in eighth grade. We've been there since he was in first grade. So he doesn't really remember what it was like when he went to a more traditional school. But they complain sometimes because there is no one to blame but themselves if they aren't making the progress that they want to make. They are in the hot seat for really driving their journey. And it's a lot of work for them to get the points and earn the badges and make the progress that they plan to make at the beginning of the year when they set their goals, their badge goals for the year. I will tell you that they have never once complained that they're bored at school. It's impossible to be bored, which is striking because the majority of dropouts cite boredom as the number one reason why they leave school.
Wow, really?
It is impossible to be bored at a school that is open-ended, where you can move forward and explore as fast as you want to and as deeply as you want to through the curriculum. And also, they are critical thinkers. There's so much discussion and there's so much peer critique that I can't complain that they're doing rote memorization or just preparing for standardized testing. So as a parent, I really appreciate that.
Do they even take the standardized tests or how does that work?
They take a test once a year just to make sure that they're on level. And so I think right now they're taking the Iowa test.
Yeah, because one question would just be, this is a nice adventure. I mean, I can hear in my head some of those bureaucrats from the state school board back when you were 17, right? Saying, nice, that's fun. And I think that's great, except we got to make sure kids learn these things and we have these standards. And I mean, you know, I guess there's potentially a tension between that. I don't know if it's real or not, right? That, you know, you're basically saying yes, do the test, but so much more, right? And then some people saying, well, it's hard enough just to get the test, right?
I love the movie Most Likely to Succeed. Have you seen that movie that features High Tech High School in San Diego?
I have seen that. Yes.
It's a great one that hits at the topic of the tests, because I do think schools should be accountable. I think there's a important role for testing, mostly for helping students gauge where they are with the learning so they can calibrate. If we don't have any view into how we're stacking up, then it's hard to set goals. So testing and assessment are an important part of learning, especially if it creates a virtuous feedback loop that can then govern our path moving forward.
Right.
But we all know that there's something that's not working about these summative tests at the end of the year that don't actually inform where we go next.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you said Khan Academy, right? And I do Khan Academy myself. My kids do it. I've helped lots of kids do this. And it's like testing every 30 seconds, because you're getting these, you get problems, and you, if you don't understand them, you keep getting more problems, and you watch a video to fill in gaps. And so it's very much kind of more of a continuous assessment. But I don't think anybody feels about that the same way they do about, you know, here in Arizona, it's the AZ merit test. It's every year this, I mean, my kids come home in tears. It's like, we got to eat a good breakfast, and yeah, like, I can't sleep. I need to sleep. My teacher said I have to sleep. And it's this like high stakes thing, where as opposed to just do the problems. And if you miss it, that means that you have an opportunity to learn something as part of your, was it hero's journey?
Right. That's right. That's right. You know, and I do think, and from someone who has taught computer coding, there is something even from the development work of those online platforms that distinguishes a high agency platform from one that's not. And I would say it's whether it's oriented towards the learners as the drivers of their pathway, or it's the teachers who are assigning the next assignment. So Khan Academy does such a good job of giving the learner the knowledge map and saying, here's your energy points, and here's how you're doing, and here's what's next for you. Which skill do you want to do next? Whereas there's, and at Acton Academy, they have a platform called the Journey Tracker, and it's all student facing. Whereas you see other platforms that are much more geared toward informing the teacher of the student's status, they call it, and the teacher dashboard. And I think that's indicative of just how, what the environment's like. There's a professor at UT in Texas who, named Jennifer Adair, who said that she walks into a classroom and one of the first things she asks is this a high agency classroom? And that was a really great metric of just, does she observe children owning their learning and diving into the deeper learning that results from that? Or is it more of a compliance mentality?
That's so interesting. I mean, think about going through life with a compliance mentality. And it's like, I'm being conditioned to be a cog in someone's corporate machine someday, right? Do a job that I think we all know is going to be a robot by the time we get there. So you're chasing something that is increasingly doesn't even exist, as opposed to being an agent, right? Someone that can go out and create the future in a lot of ways. And that's super empowering. It's almost like scary how empowering that truly can be.
Well, if you think about the options, some people say, I don't know if my child could thrive in an environment that's high agency. But to me, that doesn't mean, so resist that environment. To me, it means help equip that child.
Get them ready. Life is
get them ready.
Could you say?
Exactly.
It's like, exactly. If my child can't thrive in a high agency environment, it's almost like we're living the wrong, we made a bad decision by existing, right? Like that's a little crazy. Interesting. Well, this has been fascinating. Anything else you'd like to add about, you know, just helping create agency? We didn't get into the tactics as much. I know you work with a lot of educators on how to do that, and there's lots of things specifically that they can do in their classrooms.
Yeah, I'll mention two practical things. One is to start with buy-in. So help the students at the beginning of the year to develop a contract for what they want to achieve during the year, what their expectations are of themselves and of each other in order to learn as much as they want to during the year, and just get buy-in. So it's not a top-down rules, but it's really what, as a community, what are the boundaries that we're agreeing to establish? And then the second is to give choice. So find opportunities whenever possible to give choice. Should the desks be arranged in clusters, or should they be arranged in rows? How do we want to present our learning at the end of the exhibition? That kind of thing. So that there starts to be more of a community feel as opposed to a top-down feel to the classroom.
Interesting. Yeah, you think about choice. I mean, how many choices? I remember multiple times in school, you know, where I had to do a report about something. And it's like, how hard would it have been to just let me pick? Like, what if I want to do a report about this instead of that? And I've seen, we did a test camp on this here at I just brought 10 kids into my office and had them do a week-long summer camp. And I told them, you get to choose the topic, but you have to know more about it than I do by the end of the week. And it was a really fascinating thing because they, you know, they dug in, they took it seriously. Some of them just reused reports from that they had already done from school, but most of them, you know, looked at it as an opportunity to really shine, and they loved it, right? Just being able to choose from a list. And it was topics that I never would have thought to. It wasn't hard to know more than I do about some of these animals that I had never heard of before. So it was pretty fun.
I love it. And sometimes it is those little things that start to change the culture.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Heather, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing about your experience with blended learning, and specifically how blended learning can kind of help kids take that agency, take the ownership of their own education. I think the work you're doing with school districts is fascinating. I think your experience kind of piloting it with your kids is fascinating. And I'm looking forward to hearing about your future research and writing. And I need to get that workbook and start cranking through it.
Thank you, Kelly. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Prenda Podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or innovating in education. And if you want to follow my progress designing a new model for school, you can learn more at school.prenda.co.